and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, "Play radio station, Talking Information Center."
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJM Framingham.
It is time now to begin the reading of today's Boston Globe for this Friday, the 6th of March, 2026. And with today's Boston Globe, we say hello to Pam and Pamela.
Trump fires Noam after GOP grilling. Homeland Security Chief at Center of Controversies. President Trump fires his embattled Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, on Thursday, announced plans to replace her with Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma after she was grilled by Republican lawmakers this week at congressional hearings on a variety of topics, including her knowledge of a contract with a politically connected firm. Trump announced the change on social media, along with a new and previously non-existent role for Noem, special envoy for the Shield of the Americas, which he said would be a new security initiative for the Western Hemisphere. Trump is close with Mullen, a Republican, and speaks with him regularly. Mullen said that Noem had done the best that she could do under the circumstances, but that he hoped to learn from her tenure and build off things that didn't quite go as planned. Noem, the first cabinet member to be ousted in Trump's second term, had been among the key figures in the administration's fulfilling his mass deportation effort, which he campaigned aggressively on and which was heavily influenced by Stephen Miller, a top White House advisor. But her tenure had been marked by a string of controversies, and her fate had been the focus of speculation among Trump's allies for several weeks. On Thursday, the president contradicted remarks that Noem made under penalty of perjury in her hearing before a Senate panel on Tuesday, that Trump had signed off on a border security advertising campaign featuring Noem. "I never knew anything about it," Trump told Reuters. A White House spokesperson declined to comment and referred a true reporter to Trump's comments to Reuters. Noem has faced scrutiny from lawmakers about the campaign, on which the government spent $220 million. The ads prominently featured Noem, including in a scene filmed on horseback at Mount Rushmore in the former South Dakota's governor's home state. Press at a separate hearing on Tuesday about the process for awarding the contracts behind the ad campaign, Noem said it all went through a very competitive process, that no political appointees were involved. On Wednesday, she said the contract was all done correctly, all done legally. Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana, forcefully questioned Noem over ad contracts. Kennedy told reporters on Thursday that he received a call from the president about her testimony. "Put it this way," he said, "his recollection and her recollection are different." Kennedy said Tuesday he had spoken with White House officials ahead of Tuesday's hearing to warn them that he'd be asking Noem some tough questions. During the hearing, Kennedy repeatedly pressed Noem over a ProPublica report that found the strategy group, a firm based in Ohio, had been paid in connection with the campaign. The firm is led by Ben Yoho, who is married to Tricia McLaughlin, Noem's former spokesperson who recently left the department. The firm posted on social media on Wednesday that it had a subcontract with a firm that had a contract with the department, and that it was a different entity that held the larger contract. Noem defended the campaign as important to Trump's immigration agenda. "The president tasked me with getting the message out to the country," she told Kennedy. Skeptical, Kennedy repeatedly asked Noem whether Trump signed off before the ad campaign. She replied, "We had that conversation, yes, before I was put in this position and sworn in and confirmed, and since then as well." She then reiterated that the advertisements had been extremely effective. Kennedy, who has not been among Noem's most vocal critics, shot back, "Well, they were effective in your name recognition." Then he added that she had put Trump in a terribly awkward spot. At another point, Kennedy asked her about her unfounded complaints that Alex Pretty and Renee Good, the two U.S. citizens killed by federal immigration agents in Minneapolis, had committed acts of domestic terrorism. Citing an Axios report, Kennedy accused Noem of blaming those comments on Miller. "Do you think it's fair to blame Mr. Miller for your words?" he asked. Noem dismissed the report as false. Miller, in posts on the social site X, called Pretty an assassin and a domestic terrorist. Noam's tenure was filled with controversy. From the beginning, she was aggressive in becoming the public messenger of the president's mass deportation campaign. She starred in ads urging immigrants to leave the country, appeared on television regularly, and even did a video inside a Salvadoran prison holding Venezuelan migrants who had been shipped out under wartime powers. Some inside her department felt Noam using her perch as secretary to advance her political ambitions. Noam's response to the shooting of Pretkin in January, perhaps more than any other moment during her tenure, invited questions about whether she was up to the task of running the department. After the shooting, Noam immediately called Pretty a domestic terrorist and even alleged he was brandishing a gun, a charge that was later undermined by initial review of the incident. Noam met with Trump in the Oval Office after the incident, and he continued to support her. But crucially, Trump empowered Todd Holman to head up the operations in Minneapolis and calm the situation. Noam's decision to empower Gregory Bovino, a Border Patrol official, further roiled the department. Bovino was seen by some inside the administration as inflaming an already volatile situation in cities where Noam empowered him to do intensive immigration operations. Bovino seemed to revel in aggressive tactics and shows of force, not normally associated with customs and border protection. Tapping Bovino to lead immigration operations was unusual, since border agents are typically stationed at the southern and northern borders. His operations, while yielding many arrests, often led to lawsuits and images of agents chasing immigrants in Home Depot parking lots. Those images alarmed online influencers popular with Trump's political base, including the popular podcast host Joe Rogan. Soon after Holman arrived in Minneapolis, Bovino was sent back to his position in California. Some of Noam's other moves faced resistance inside the department, in particular, her empowering of Corey Lewandowski, a senior advisor who has become a powerful figure in the agency. A decision to polygraph people suspected of leaking information also caused consternation throughout the department. Pam?
As war intensifies, vets stress human cost, concerns about an open-ended commitment. American military veterans are voicing strong reactions about the intensifying war in Iran, support for confronting a brutal regime, wariness about the long-term consequences, and questions about government transparency and trust. In interviews, veterans from Vietnam to Iraq expressed anger about hundreds of past American casualties from Iranian-backed militias and munitions, while also calling for a public explanation of why U.S. service members are being put in harm's way. By Thursday, six American service members had been killed. There's no love lost with Iran in this, but on the other side, you're worried about a new forever war, said Jack Hammond, a retired Army Brigadier General who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. What worries us is going back to those two previous wars, where we didn't have very clearly defined objectives or withdrawal criteria. Hammond recounted Iran's role in the 1983 truck bombing of Marine barracks in Beirut, where 220 Marines, 18 sailors, and 3 soldiers were killed. The Iranian regime also was responsible for introducing armor-piercing roadside bombs in Iraq, killing and wounding hundreds of U.S. service members there. Just remember the history here, said Micah Jones, a Republican congressional candidate from Essex and a former Army captain who served in Afghanistan. The regime has been in power for 47 years, and they have been the largest state sponsor of terrorism throughout the world, and a regime that is focused on harming American interests. However, a majority of American voters do not support the war, according to several recent polls. An NBC News survey indicated that 54% of voters do not approve of President Trump's handling of the strikes. And a Fox News poll showed that 51% believe the Iranian operation has made the United States less safe. Questions about the war have revolved around its aims, why it was started, and what happens after the shooting stops. Trump and administration officials have offered varying reasons for the bombing of Iran. Regime change, eliminating the country's nuclear capability, or countering an imminent military threat. For Lynn Holley, 45, an Air Force veteran from Brookline, the The objectives are muddled. "I don't know what the end game is," Holy said. "It seems that this administration has kicked some hornet's nest without consideration of what will come in the short term or even the long term. War is an ugly thing. We know that, and I have more questions than answers." "I'm very concerned," added Holy, a graduate of the Air Force Academy. I'll be surprised if the outcome is better than what we had in Afghanistan and Iraq, but I think there will be parallels. "In all wars, the human cost lingers long after the last bombs have fallen," said Coleman Nee, the national commander of the Disabled American Veterans and a former Massachusetts Secretary of Veterans Services. "It's heartbreaking that we have more Gold Star families, and that a somber reminder that these things aren't priceless, that they come with a cost," said Nee, referring to a designation for service members who died on active duty. "My fervent hope is that the government and the administration not only look to shorten this as soon as possible, but that there's a recognition that this will create issues and health problems for people who are coming back," Nee said. Representative Seth Moulton, a four-tour Marine veteran of Iraq, echoed concerns for service members fighting what he called Trump's war of choice, as opposed to a war of necessity. "Trump shrugged and said casualties often happen in war, and now they have," said Moulton, a frequent critic of the president who was running against Senator Ed Markey, a fellow Democrat. "Our troops and Gold Star families deserve reverence, not callousness," Moulton said in a statement. "It's not lost on many that Trump has called our troops suckers for serving, losers for dying, and attacked John McCain, the former senator and Vietnam POW, for getting captured in a war." The Atlantic reported in 2020 that during a 2018 trip to France, Trump referred to fallen U.S. Marines buried there as suckers and losers for being killed in action. Retired Marine General John Kelly, who served Trump as White House Chief of Staff, later confirmed that the president made those remarks. Trump has defended his decision to go to war with Iran as a noble mission to neutralize the menace of a longtime adversary. "We're doing this not for now, we're doing this for the future," the president said after launching the attack. He has also acknowledged that potential for more American casualties. "For many veterans, the recent deaths in the Iran war have brought back painful memories. It hits personally for me. I lost 22 shipmates on my Vietnam deployment," said Neil Gordon, 78, a Navy veteran of the Vietnam War who lives in Brookline. He also criticized what he called the administration's lack of transparency and conflicting rationale for going to war in the first place. "We've not seen a credible, consistent argument for why we are going to war," Gordon added. "I can't trust anything that this administration tells me. What we see is the administration pretending it's not a war, even though they call it a war." The strikes were launched without seeking congressional authorization or by building a broad public argument for the need to go to war with Iran, as had been done before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. "You have to make your case to the American people," said Hammond, the retired general who is now executive director of Homebase, a nonprofit organization that treats the hidden wounds of war. "We learned this in Vietnam. If you don't have the support of the American people, we're screwed." In the meantime, Maureen Gilbert, an Army veteran and junior vice commander of American Legion Post 16 in Mattapan, reflected on the casualties that might lie ahead. "How many more do we have to give?" Gilbert said. "A lot of us civilians are losing jobs. We can barely survive. So what is he really proving? He's not worrying about the worth of our lives or the lives of our veterans."
Emma?
Mission, hostilities, Republicans toil to avoid calling it a war. When President Trump gave reporters a brief update this week on the accelerated bombing campaign against Iran, he said, "We're doing very well on the war front." That complicated matters for Republicans on Capitol Hill, who have spent the day since the U.S.-Israeli attacks began engaging in semantic gymnastics to describe the widening conflict as a major combat operation, a mission, hostilities, or really just anything other than war. "They declared war on us," House Speaker Mike Johnson said of Iran as he repeated the administration's justification for the offensive. Still, he quickly added, there was, in fact, no war. "We're not at war right now," he said Wednesday. We're 4 days into a very specific, clear mission, an operation. The verbal gyrations reflect the tricky politics of an unpopular war, especially for a party that has long condemned forever wars on foreign soil. They also underscore the legal and constitutional questions raised by Trump's decision to begin offensive against Iran without congressional approval. Under the Constitution, only Congress can declare war. But most Republicans on Capitol Hill have taken the position that it's up to the president alone whether to commit U.S. forces to a military mission whose objectives, scope, and duration remain a big question mark. It's not a war, Representative Randy Fine, Republican of Florida, said as he made his way to the House floor on Wednesday, employing some tautological reasoning. The way you're officially at war is Congress declares war, and we haven't declared war. As the Senate prepared to vote on whether Trump needed to win approval from Congress for the mission, many Republicans employed an exceedingly narrow definition of what would constitute war. They argued that, so far, at least, what was happening in the Middle East was not it. Representative Ken Calvert, Republican of California, chair of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, said it was not a boots-on-the-ground issue so much as a time frame issue. This has been about 72 hours, he said. I would call it an operation at this point. House narrowly rejects Iran War Powers Resolution. The House narrowly rejected a War Powers Resolution Thursday to halt President Trump's attacks on Iran, an early sign of unease in Congress over the rapidly widening conflict that is reordering U.S. priorities at home and abroad. It's the second vote in as many days after the Senate defeated a similar measure along party lines. Lawmakers are confronting the sudden reality of representing weary Americans in wartime and all that entails, with lives lost, dollars spent, and alliances tested by a president's unilateral decision to go to war with Iran. While the tally in the House, 212-219, was expected to be tight, the outcome provided a clarifying snapshot of political support for and opposition to the U.S.-Israeli military operation, and Trump's rationale for bypassing Congress, which alone has the power to declare war. At the Capitol, the conflict has quickly carried echoes of the long wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and many September 11th-era veterans now serve in Congress. Donald Trump is not a king, and if he believes the war with Iran is in our national interest, then he must come to Congress and make the case, said Representative Gregory Meeks, the top Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The House also approved a separate measure affirming that Iran is the largest state sponsor of terrorism. Yeah?
Housing boom gives Lexington pause. Change is happening too quickly for some. For centuries, one of the tallest points in this town's historic center has been Belfry Hill, where a replica of the old wooden tower whose bells rang out at the start of the battles that began the Revolutionary War has long stood. Soon, the Belfry may have a more modern neighbor, almost as tall, a four-story mixed-use development that will include more than 50 new homes. The new building still requires approvals from a few municipal boards, including the town's Historic Districts Commission. But if all goes to plan, it would pave the way for a building that, to many, symbolizes the change suddenly sweeping through a community whose identity is tied to events of 250 years ago, and the preservation of it. Lexington is set to add around 1,600 new apartments and condominiums in the coming years, turning this community of 35,000, which has built little in decades, into the state's new housing boomtown. All of those new homes are the result of the ambitious plan Lexington passed in 2023 under the state's MBTA Communities Act. Even as other towns mulled rebellion, affluent, liberal Lexington became the first place to pass new zoning rules under the law, allowing tall, dense buildings in key parts of town, and won plaudits from advocates, state officials, and even a glowing article in the New Yorker. But the reality of so much growth so quickly is complicated. Once enthused residents are now grappling with what it means to help lead the state out of a deep housing shortage. There are worries about overstuffed schools and strained roads. The prospect of new apartments in the town's treasured historic district has been particularly jarring to some. And last year, town meeting voted to roll back the MBTA community zoning, slowing the flow of new projects to a trickle. "I'm all for us playing our part in solving the state's housing issue," said Tina McBride, a planning board member who helped lead the rollback effort. "Things and places are always going to change, and that can be a good thing, but there is such a thing as too much growth." Alan Levine has lived in a small home on Reed Street since the 1980s. He knows every corner of Lexington, and on a recent drive through town, he could point out every parcel that is slated for redevelopment. He passed two squat commercial buildings on Bedford Street next to his dentist's office that will soon become 25 apartments. A few blocks away, an old single-family home surrounded by a parking lot will become 7 condominiums. A little trafficked office park a few minutes from Lexington Center is going to be demolished in favor of nearly 300 apartments. And wood framing is already up on a building that will house more than 300 apartments among the low-slung office parks of Hartwell Avenue. "Lexington is changing," Levine said. "It's all happening very quickly." The stage was set in spring 2023 when officials and well-known residents pushed forward a plan that would rezone 227 acres, including parts of Lexington Center and old office buildings near Route 128. Allowing heights up to 6 stories with few restrictions on density. They estimated the plan would generate between 400 and 800 new units over a decade, a move, they said, that would position the town as a progressive leader on one of the state's most intractable problems. "This is a chance for Lexington to lead," Mike Keneally, the state's former Secretary of Housing and Economic Development, and a Lexington resident said ahead of the town meeting vote on the plan. "Isn't that what we want to do?" Town meeting passed the plan with more than 60% in favor. Renowned climate activist Bill McKibben, a former Lexington resident, hailed the town in a New Yorker article. "A Massachusetts town leads a way out of the housing crisis." And Governor Maura Healey sent her personal congratulations. But Lexington underestimated just how much demand there would be to build in Lexington. Developers, big and small, lined up with ideas for underused parking lots and key corners, and the new plan meant those buildings didn't need special review. One of the state's wealthiest suburbs, a place where the median single-family home price last year was $1.8 million, was suddenly wide open for development. "We did not necessarily expect the market to react so quickly," said Planning Director Abigail McCabe, "but the zoning was designed to create new housing. And in that respect, it was and still is successful. Today, more than 1,600 units are under construction, approved, or in approval process in Lexington, all of them in multi-unit buildings, a big shift from the sprawling single-family homes on large lots that predominate here. In the prior decade, Lexington had approved just 2 multifamily units. But ask around, and most in Lexington will say they want to help Massachusetts dig out of its housing crisis. Everyone knows someone who is struggling with the high cost of rent. But when actual projects start to materialize, feelings begin to shift. Residents were alarmed when the condo development 89 Bedford Street went before the planning board, fearing that the project would disturb the character of the neighborhood and exacerbate flooding issues. But because the project was filed under the more permissive new zoning rules, there wasn't much they could do about it. Soon there was a full-fledged push to dramatically scale down the zoning. Some residents say that they'd been misled about the scale of what the plan allowed. Keneally, now a Republican candidate for governor, has flipped his stance on the law and is on the campaign trail, criticizing Healey's enforcement of the guidelines he helped write while working in the Baker administration. "People started seeing the reality," said Lynn Jensen, a town meeting member who was elected to the planning board on Monday. "The growth we're seeing now is unplanned, and we didn't have any say in what got approved." The influx of new apartments added fuel to last year's debate over whether to spend $660 million on a new high school, with some residents worried that the school would not be big enough to hold all the newcomers. But still, voters approved the plan in December. There were other concerns, too. Could Lexington roads handle so many new vehicles? Could the police force keep up? And who exactly are these fancy new buildings for? The cheapest condo at 89 Bedford Street is listed at $1.2 million. Last year, Jensen helped lead an effort to roll back the plan, reducing the MBTA community zone from 227 acres to 90 and tightening density and height limits. Town meeting approved it 164 to 9 with 5 abstentions. One of the 9 who opposed the rollback was Kunal Batla, Lexington's youngest town meeting member. The 20-year-old, who also ran for planning board this month but lost, is among those who see all the new housing as the good thing. Yes, the growth is a lot to absorb all at once, he said, but Lexington's previous strategy simply drove prices out of reach. New housing might actually benefit places like Lexington Center, which, for all its history, also holds a four-lane road, a sea of parking lots, and some small commercial buildings whose tenants constantly turn over. More housing would mean more customers, he said, and it would give more opportunity for people like him to stay and build a life in the town where they grew up. He, for one, sees a future for himself in town, perhaps in a studio apartment in that big project on Hartwell Avenue. Of course, we want to be measured about our approach to growth, said Batla, who was living with his parents while in school at Tufts University. At the same time, it is important for places like Lexington to keep growing and changing so people like me can live here and contribute to making it a better place.
RFK Jr., not exactly sweet on Dunkin'. The health secretary put the Canton-based chain on notice for its sugary beverages. As health secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., ticked through a list of ways the Trump administration is trying to clean up the nation's food supply before an appreciative Texas crowd last week, he previewed more to come, including potentially pulling certain ingredients from the market if they can't be proven safe. And then he singled out a Massachusetts staple. We're going to ask Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks, show us the safety data that shows that it's okay for a teenage girl to drink an iced coffee with 115 grams of sugar in it, Kennedy told the applauding audience. I don't think they're going to be able to do it. It's unclear if the administration will follow through on such demands and restrict sugary beverages at Dunkin' and similar chains, despite Kennedy's declarative state comments at the Austin food-focused event, organized by an outside political group that supports his agenda. The Health and Human Services Department did not respond to a request for further explanation. The warning comes as Kennedy is leaning heavily into his agenda to improve American diets, a popular initiative the administration has recently played up as if his unpopular overhaul of childhood vaccine schedule. It also comes as the administration is working on a proposal to more seriously scrutinize food ingredients, one that, if it resembles Kennedy's preview, could upend the nation's food supply. Dunkin' did not respond to requests for comment. Kennedy's push to reform the system of food ingredient approval, called generally recognized as safe, began early in his tenure, and is in line with what nutrition advocates on both sides of the aisle have wanted for years. The GRAS category was originally designed for common ingredients like vinegar and salt, so companies wouldn't have to apply for approval to use them. But over time, it has come to include thousands of new ingredients, including those in ultra-processed foods. A proposed regulatory action to tighten the approval system is under review by the White House, according to a government database, though specifics are not public. The administration is also weighing how to respond to a citizen petition from David Kessler, a pediatrician and former Food and Drug Administration commissioner. In the petition, Kessler argues that the FDA should revoke recognition of refined carbohydrates and sweeteners as safe and require companies to petition anew for their approval as a food additive. Kessler argued the law already would allow the FDA to find such products not proven safe and notes the burden is on companies to demonstrate the safety of their offerings. Such a policy could have massive effects on the food industry, which produces a large number of products that contain refined carbohydrates, many of them ultra-processed. Some studies estimate nearly 75% of the nation's food supply falls into that category. In a conversation with reporters last month, one of Kennedy's top advisors, Callie Means, pointed to the Kessler petition also in the context of sugary coffee. They're required by law to have studies of what they're putting in the food is safe, Means said. So the Kessler petition brings out this question. Okay, let's see the studies. Means demurred on whether the agency was officially announcing such a plan. It's unclear which specific Dunkin' offerings Kennedy and Means are citing. According to the chain's posted nutrition facts, some of its beverages do contain more than 100 grams of sugar, including some culottas and frozen coffees. A medium coffee with cream and sugar has 27 grams. A single glazed donut has 13 grams of sugar. Legal and nutrition experts say the candy is right to call it drinks with exorbitant amounts of sugar, and that, in theory, the administration could legally try to restrict all sweeteners or set limits on how much could be added to foods. But it would take a level of regulatory focus and resources the administration has not shown, they said, and could have massive implications for food that would likely draw significant pushback. It's legally feasible. I don't see it happening, said Jennifer Pomerantz, a public health professor at New York University. She noted that similar efforts for years to push for limits to added salt in foods have gone nowhere. Marion Nestle, an author and nutrition expert, said that if the administration wanted to only limit sugar and not ban it entirely, it would have to provide science to justify a clear limit, which could prove difficult. I would agree that the idea of drinking a product that has 115 grams of sugar in it is a very bad idea. I would not recommend it, Nestle said. But the reality of the food supply is that sugar is in everything. They want sugar out of everything? Fine. Where's the regulation? I want to see the regulation. Kennedy has delivered mixed messages on sugar and other foods. In Austin, as he and others extolled the virtues of real food and home cooking, guests were served cheeseburgers and fries from Steak and Shake, a fast food chain that Kennedy has praised for switching its frying oil to beef tallow. He frequently refers to it as poison, but also has praised Coca-Cola for offering its soda with cane sugar instead of a high-fructose corn syrup. He says Americans should feel free to drink a Coke or eat a donut, if that's what they want, as long as they know the risks. He has also said ultra-processed foods are making Americans sick, but an interview with 60 Minutes about the Kessler petition said he wasn't suggesting restricting them. I'm not saying we're going to regulate ultra-processed food, Kennedy said. Our job is to make sure that everybody understands what they're getting, to have an informed public. Kennedy and Means have been particularly critical, though, of children eating sugar and such foods, especially in school lunches. Recently updated federal dietary guidelines, which are developed jointly under the Agricultural Department, advise not giving children any added sugar under age 11. There's no way that we're going to end this health care crisis that's bankrupting our country unless we fix the chronic disease epidemic, Kennedy said as he closed his speech. It's a crime against our kids, and our generation now has a chance to fix it.
History is being erased in Lowell. Videos about exploited 19th century mill workers have been removed from the Lowell National Historical Park following President Trump's executive order. The following things happened in Lowell in the 19th century. Girls as young as 10 worked 12-hour days, 6 days a week, in hot, unhealthy textile mills with little ventilation. The harsh conditions led the mill workers to organize the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association, which pushed for a 10-hour workday. Its newspaper, The Voice of Industry, took strong stands against war and slavery, and many workers stood in solidarity with the enslaved Africans who harvested the cotton spun in those very mills. Apparently, President Trump doesn't want you to know about all of this, because in accordance with his executive order, Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, two videos about the mill workers shown at the Lowell National Historical Park have been removed. Lowell, The Continuing Revolution, is one of the two missing films, still available online if not on the park website. It's a standard overview of the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, mostly supporting the narrative of benevolent mill owners and young women happy to be liberated from farm drudgery to earn their own money. But the film does describe the air in the mills as swarming with lint, leaving the workers susceptible to lung disease, and says that owners looking to optimize profits regularly cut wages, leading to strikes. Since the U.S. Interior Department's directives enforcing Trump's order compel the National Park Service to flag for removal any materials that inappropriately disparage Americans past or living, the educational videos had to go. Every American should be alarmed that this is happening, said Kristen Sykes, Northeast Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, an independent guardian of the parks. We're just starting to see this whitewashing, and we could see much more. The association is among the plaintiffs in a recent lawsuit filed by the group Democracy Forward in federal district court in Boston, challenging Trump's authority to alter American history by executive fiat. Advocates worry that cultural institutions will begin to self-censor in order to stay out of the administration's crosshairs. In a recent visit to the park, Sykes said a guide told her that the films were being updated. The expunged videos in Lowell are just part of a sweeping attack on the country's cultural heritage, targeting stories about slavery, civil rights, climate change, and anything else disliked by this president. The range of threatened material is breathtaking, including 80 items at the Selma to Montgomery National Historic Trail in Alabama. A rainbow flag was removed from the Stonewall National Monument in New York City, which commemorates the struggle for LGBTQ rights. In Maine, signs about climate change and Native American rights were removed from Acadia National Park. Not even gift shop items are exempt. A separate order required that QR codes be installed at National Historic Sites, encouraging visitors to report any negative material they might perceive. The idea was to unleash an army of cultural vigilantes seeking out divisive topics to erase from the national memory. But oops, most of the initial comments received through the QR code criticized park funding cuts and the administration's efforts to rewrite history. The courts have tried to put a stop to some of the more egregious revisionism. In addition to the Democracy Forward suit, last month, a federal judge ruled that a dismantled panel discussing the 9 enslaved people at George Washington's home at the Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia must be restored. The judge, appointed by Republican President George W. Bush, quoted George Orwell's dystopian 1984 and said that Trump did not have the right to dissemble historical truths. But why does it matter if a couple of videos about a 200-year-old industrial history are removed from the Lowell National Park? For Robert Forant, a professor of labor history at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, the stories are searingly relevant today. "We're diminishing the history of working people," he said, "and without a shared understanding of labor's hard-fought rights, it's easier to ride roughshod over them." Indeed, in his second term, Trump has slashed funding for occupational health and safety and equal employment agencies, forced Labor Department workers into early retirement, and, under the guise of national security, stripped collective bargaining rights from hundreds of thousands of federal workers. For this administration, the less Americans know about the organized struggle for workers' rights, including government workers, the better. Because one thing the Trump administration does understand, knowledge is power.
Boston honors first casualty of American Revolution. On March 5, 1770, Crispus Attucks and a large crowd of American colonists confronted British soldiers on the night of what later became known as the Boston Massacre. The British soldiers shot into the crowd, killing Attucks, a formerly enslaved black and indigenous sailor. He was the first person killed during the massacre, and thus the first person killed during the American Revolution. 256 years later, Mary Michelle Wu said Attucks embodied the struggle for freedom long before the nation formally declared independence. She said the fight for justice and civil engagement in America was not over. In moments of challenge and in moments of conflict, it does feel easier to put your head down, Wu said in an event at the Old State House commemorating Attucks. Remembering the full history pushes us to be the beacon of freedom that the rest of the country and the rest of the world so very much needs. Inside the Old State House's council chambers, city leaders, historians, and students gathered to celebrate Attucks' legacy. They talked about the importance of memorializing him during a time when many present said the contributions of people of color to American history were being erased by the Trump administration, and the country's founding principles were under attack. Senator Lydia Edwards said the death of Attucks and the 4 others killed during the Boston Massacre helped establish the important legal principles that still guide the country today. Following the killings, British soldiers involved in the incident were put on trial. John Adams, who later became president, agreed to defend them in court, arguing that the rule of law must be upheld even during times of intense conflict. even in these moments of strife, oppression of rogue federal government, that we remember that we stood up and still held to our court system, to the rule of law, and to due process, Edward said. We also remember who had to die in order to remind ourselves to do that. City Councilor Brian Worrell said Attucks was a symbol of the long struggle for equality in the country. It's a story that's a reminder that black and indigenous Americans have always been at the forefront of the fight for justice, Worrell said. He said when he recounts Boston's black history, he almost always starts with Attucks' story. He fought not simply against the tea tax or the Stamp Act. He fought for the most basic of rights. He fought for equal human lives. It's a fight we as a city are still having, he said. Wu spoke about how on March 5, 2025, she was called to testify before Congress about Boston's immigration policies during a six-hour hearing. She touted Boston's safety record amid aggressive questioning, arguing that these immigration policies improved public safety. On the 255th anniversary of the Boston Massacre, on Crispus Attucks Day, there was no way that this city wasn't going to be represented in standing up for what's right, Wu said. A chandelier lit the council chamber and red curtains covered historic windows. On both sides of the room, students sat with their teachers. Winners of the Crispus Attucks Essay Contest, which invites local students to explore Attucks' legacy, sat next to the podium. Sometimes history repeats itself, said Toni Martin, an attendee at the event, who came to support her niece, who was being awarded. Sometimes it gets better, but it takes revolutionary people to make the change perfect. Outside the State House, at the commemoration, Sharon Pullum, 18, who came in second for the essay contest, said, "My inspiration was just getting the opportunity to speak on something that matters." Michael Kelly, 65, joined the wreath-laying ceremony that took place at the Boston Massacre Commemorative Plaza. Kelly held a sign that said, "Ice out, be good," referring to Rene Good, a U.S. citizen who was shot and killed by immigration agents in Minneapolis earlier this year. Kelly said he'd been standing in the plaza for 3 hours and is planning to stand there the entire day. People can stretch their imaginations to understand that this place, what happened here, is not all that different than what happened in Minneapolis, Kelly said, with tears in his eyes. People standing up for something they believe in is vastly important, and we can't be daunted.
What a kick. The tiny board reminds us what elected officials with a spine look like. By Yvonne Abram, Globe columnist. Go, 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 select persons of Foxborough. The President of the United States appears to be a sucker for the glitz and glamour of FIFA, the soccer's global governing body. The leader of the free world positively melted when they gave him that gaudy, golden, suck-uppy, pretend peace prize. But municipal leaders in this town are not so easily impressed. The 2026 FIFA World Cup starts in a few months, and seven of the games will be played at Gillette Stadium, which falls under the town's purview. Security for the massive sporting event will require some $7.8 million in extra funding, and the folks who run Foxborough do not want to be left holding the bag for it. And they refuse to issue a license until somebody coughed up the money. I've seen people saying, oh, there's no way they won't issue the license, Select Board Vice Chair Stephanie McGowan said in February. I'm going to tell you, this board will not issue this license. Attorneys representing FIFA and the event assured the Select Board that they were good for the money if expected federal funding doesn't come through. Members of the Select Board were not inclined to trust them on that, or anything really. They made it clear that they want the equipment they need to keep fans safe in hand, and paid for ASAP. With all due respect, this has been going on for months, said Select Board member and chiropractor Mark Elfman. I don't understand why we are sitting here again today. It seems like to me, a simple little board member that I am, that the experts are telling you what they need, and you're trying to nickel and dime them. You tell them. There is something truly inspiring about this standoff. Elfman and the other simple little board members paid $90 per month to serve their community, by the way, stood up to FIFA, a massive and historically corrupt organization that expects to make more than $11 billion in revenues from this year's competition. The video of Tuesday's meeting makes for a pretty compelling viewing. It took place in the same kind of nondescript, too-bright municipal chamber where tens of thousands of mundane and momentous decisions are made every day in this country. There, select board members, the town manager, and other officials do the thankless and usually invisible work that keeps society from falling apart. These Foxborough heroes approved licenses for the Jaycees' concerts on the Common from June through August. The Boyden Library Teddy Bear Picnic is on for 11 a.m. Emily Adler was added to the Council on Aging and Human Services Advisory Board. And they marked the passing of Mrs. Roberts of the Roberts and Sons Funeral Home, who was always so kind. It was all aggressively Quixotian and absolutely vital. What made this different is that seven cameras and a bunch of reporters were on hand to record it, but board members did not wilt in that unfamiliar spotlight. We're 99 or 100 days away from hosting the largest sporting event in the world, and we're deciding, or can't seem to find, necessary funding for necessary equipment that's been identified in over a year and a half of planning, with thousands of hours in 14 working groups, said Police Chief Michael Grace. The solution is very simple. Fund what we need, and this issue is over tomorrow. They were united, the Davids, against a gilded Goliath. We live in a time when too few of the people who could take a stand for ordinary people are actually doing it. Republicans in Congress refuse to govern, allowing Trump administration officials to cast them aside as they attack other countries and impose tariffs and smash appropriations, all of which used to be the most important part of the job on Capitol Hill. The richest men on the planet run the place with no meaningful resistance, expanding their unimaginable wealth and power, utterly unhindered by person or law. The rest of us are getting ground up in their brutal machinery. Not in Foxborough, though. There, they refused to roll over, and it was magnificent. Here's the kicker. Finally, the FIFA group proposed to pay the town security costs. It might just be the first win of the 2026 World Cup.
A symphony withdrawn from the Kennedy Center as Trump took over will be performed by BSO instead. Composer Philip Glass withdrew his Lincoln Symphony from its June world premiere at the National Theater, citing incompatible values with Trump-held leadership. The Boston Symphony Orchestra will perform Philip Glass's new Abraham Lincoln-inspired symphony, which Glass recently withdrew from its originally slated June 2026 world premiere performance at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. The BSO announced today it will perform Glass's Symphony No. 15, Lincoln, at Tanglewood on the afternoon of Sunday, July 5th, on a program that also includes Aaron Copland's 1942 Lincoln portrait and selections from John Williams' score to Steven Spielberg's 2012 biographical film, Lincoln. In a statement provided by the orchestra, Glass said he was very pleased that the BSO would be performing the piece. The performance of this new symphony falls into the current discussion about our national identity and values, he wrote. I look forward to hearing the symphony for the first time at Tanglewood. Glass, 89, a pioneer of the musical minimalist movement and one of the most prominent living American composers, announced in late January that he was withdrawing the symphony from its scheduled world premiere performance by the National Symphony Orchestra at the Kennedy Center. Symphony No. 15 is a portrait of Abraham Lincoln, and the values of the Kennedy Center today are in direct conflict with the message of the symphony, Glass wrote in a letter shared on his Instagram. Therefore, I feel an obligation to withdraw the symphony premiere from the Kennedy Center under its current leadership. According to the New York Times, the symphony was commissioned by the National Symphony Orchestra and the Kennedy Center several years ago and was originally intended for performance in 2022, but Glass did not finish the piece in time. The performance was then rescheduled for June 12th and 13th, 2026, but the composer withdrew the symphony as President Trump sought to reshape the Kennedy Center to his own vision, a project that has been gradually ongoing since the start of Trump's second term in office. In December, the current board voted to rename the center to include Trump's name, a move that's been widely denounced by Democratic lawmakers and Kennedy family members. Several other prominent performing artists and groups included Bela Fleck, Issa Rae, the musical Hamilton, and the Martha Graham Dance Company have also canceled performances at the center. At Tanglewood, The symphony will be conducted by Karen Kamisek and feature baritone soloist Zachary James, both of whom are scheduled to take part in the scrapped Candy Center performances. Yep.
Moderna forges ahead after a series of challenges. After flu vaccine hiccups, potential $2.25 billion settlement, the Cambridge biotech awaits FDA decision and clinical trial results. Just 2 months into 2026, Moderna has weathered a number of regulatory and financial storms that could have proven catastrophic. Moderna, which is already financially struggling, announced Tuesday it will pay $950 million and ultimately up to $2.25 billion to two biotechs in a settlement over claims of patent infringement during the development of Moderna's blockbuster COVID-19 vaccine. It would be one of the largest patent settlements in history if paid in full. Less than a month ago, in a move that shocked both the Cambridge vaccine developer and the broader biotech industry, the Food and Drug Administration refused to review Moderna's application for its messenger RNA flu vaccine for older adults. Despite these high-cost bumps, Moderna has managed to eke out some temporary wins, paving the way for the company, which employs around 4,400 people in Massachusetts, to focus on its next moves. The settlement with Arbutus Biopharma Corp. and Genevant Sciences is not as bad as many feared. The company's stock was up more than 7% at market open Wednesday and continued to rise throughout the day following the news of the deal. Resolving this legacy matter from our pandemic response removes uncertainty and allows us to turn our full focus to Moderna's exciting near-term future, Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel said in a statement about the COVID settlement. And on the flu vaccine front, the FDA reversed course, eventually agreeing to review Moderna's flu vaccine after all. The agency had initially cited methodological and safety concerns with the trial design, which Moderna disputed. The fact that Moderna's ship is still afloat is a sign of resilience, although more challenges await in pivotal trial results and the FDA decision on flu shot, experts and analysts say. If Moderna can shift its business strategy as it intends, the company could be headed towards stability, said Miles Minter, a healthcare research analyst at the investment bank William Blair. Diversify away from vaccines, have an oncology top line that's growing in multiple indications, which they've set up with their partner Merck, and there is an absolute path to break even. People who have been involved with Moderna from the beginning are also hopeful. I'm very optimistic about Moderna's future, said Moderna co-founder and renowned MIT professor Robert Langer, who declined to otherwise comment on the company's next steps. Moderna has not been shy in its push to move away from the COVID products that made it famous. The company has increasingly invested in vaccines targeting cancer, rare diseases, and norovirus, which causes the seasonal stomach bug. This is increasingly important at a time when federal health officials, led by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a noted vaccine skeptic, have intensely scrutinized mRNA technology and vaccines. Last year, Kennedy announced the federal government would no longer fund work on mRNA vaccines. Moderna said it will stop investing in late-stage vaccine trials because of the growing opposition to vaccines. The risk of federal opposition to Moderna's mRNA-based cancer therapies should be viewed differently, Minter said. It's just, quite frankly, vastly different from giving someone a COVID vaccine or an influenza vaccine. While infections and risk of death from COVID-19 have decreased dramatically in recent years, patients suffering from certain cancers will almost certainly die without intervention. Patients with late-stage melanoma, for instance, have few options if their cancer returns following surgery. During a news conference on the FDA's initial decision not to review Moderna's flu shot, a senior FDA official with a background in oncology reaffirmed that the potential role of mRNA technology in cancer therapies. We've been hopeful that mRNA technology will have some spin-off platform benefits outside of infectious diseases, but it just hasn't panned out yet, said the official, who spoke under the condition they not be quoted by name. Moderna recently announced very promising clinical trial results for its vaccine to treat high-risk melanoma, a type of skin cancer, when combined with Merck's drug Keytruda. Results from the vaccine's Phase 3 trial are expected later this year. You can very quickly turn Moderna from a vaccine company into their primary revenue driver to be oncology, Minter said. Moderna's oncology pipeline is targeting several cancers in addition to melanoma, including types of lung cancer, kidney cancer, and bladder cancer. Many of these options are also being developed in partnership with Merck. It's actually really prudent that they're doing a cost-sharing program with Merck. If Moderna was on the hook to fund pivotal studies, they're talking about billions of dollars in costs that they would have to fund themselves. But Moderna has long been burning cash, although at a slower rate, and it is spending surprise investors earlier this year. Still, investors are hooked on the potential for Moderna's Hollywood-style redemption arc, said Dr. Mani Fuhar, a senior research analyst at healthcare investment bank Leerink Partners. Cancer vaccines, Farrar said, are the main driver of optimism. If cancer were not part of the story, this turnaround would still not really work. But whether Moderna could pull it off, Farrar is not so sure. Moderna could also have reasons for hope regarding vaccines against infectious diseases like COVID and the flu, despite hostility from President Trump's administration, said Melissa Moore, a former top scientist at Moderna. For one thing, although the United States is the biggest market for vaccines that protect against infectious diseases, she said regulators in other countries are far more receptive to Moderna's mRNA shots. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. I'm Pam.
And Pamela.
Have a great weekend.
These are the death notices from Friday, March 6, 2026. From Boston, Autumn C. Davis. From Brookline, Neil E. Kelleher. From Cambridge, Autumn C. Davis. From Fitchburg, Autumn C. Davis. From Framingham, Mary M. Leonard. From Lynn, Richard W. Cutts. From Medford, Autumn C. Davis. From Norwood, Mary T. Beardsley. From Wareham, Neil E. Kelleher. And from Wellesley, Neil E. Kelleher. This concludes the death notices for today.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because when people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, they can truly thrive, like Marta.
And now we'll hear from our class valedictorian, who with her hard work never ceases to amaze us. Please welcome Marta Moreno.
And Alex.
How did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
I knew it. Let's meet up later to celebrate.
And Diego.
Mom! I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project!
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations!
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. feedingamerica.org/act now. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind.